Welcome to a series of podcasts from the Vegan Information Project. In each podcast, we'll be exploring in greater depth many of the issues that arose during the workshops facilitated by Tina Cubley towards the end of the VIP mini course on social movements. Hello there, this is Tina Cubley, Roger Yates and Zam S. Hound on the VIP couch, and we're going to record our final podcast which relates to VIP workshops that were done towards the end of the mini course, as we call it, on social movements and protest, etc. So this is the fifth and final podcast in this little series, and so there are four others to find, obviously, and one was on We Are Each Other, right, Tina?
That's right. Yeah. We had the first one was introducing the essentially intersectional nature of VIP as a group which takes a view that veganism is a stance for justice against all oppression, and we explored the entangled nature of oppressions and privilege.
Okay.
And
there was the media.
We did independent media and DIY culture. We did Rights Our Evolution, which explored the feminist ethos of care and the anarchist challenge to rights theory. And we explored Marcuse's idea of the Great Refusal and its relevance to veganism and social movements.
Yes, exciting, is it, that Marcuse's ideas are kind of finding a new focus within, or should, within the vegan movement?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so the theme then for today is the final set of, I think you did, was it one or one and a half workshops on direct action, right? So
that's
the
right,
theme
yes.
Today. So set the agenda for us then, team.
Okay, I was a bit confused when I was sorting out what we would talk about in this podcast, because as tends to happen in workshops, we had a massive agenda of topics concerning the history of direct action to cover, and we ended up focusing on a few key areas, so I've tried to reflect that in the questions I've come up with. I thought we'd briefly explore the anarchist elements of direct action. We would look at the challenge of engaging with mainstream media for direct action groups. We'd also, due to the frequently adverse reaction to any advocacy of direct action as opposed to legal protest, I thought we'd have a look at the limitations of legal protest and go through a bit of what we're not saying with regard to advocating direct action.
Mm-hmm.
It might help as well to define direct action at the beginning, what distinguishes it from indirect action, because I think that can get very fuzzy. And anyway,
okay.
Do
you want to start with that, or...?
Yeah, I thought. I also thought that the intersectional nature of the history of direct action would be worth emphasising and exploring a little. And here's one where we rather got stuck in the workshop. The challenges facing a large-scale direct action movement for animal liberation in Ireland.
Yeah.
Okay. So that we got stuck on that for a while. But anyway, should we begin, then, by talking about definitions of direct action?
Yes.
What we're talking about.
So what is direct action there, team?
Thanks for putting me on the spot like that. Well, basically, as an anarchist, my definition of direct action is that it's any form of action which makes the power structure of society irrelevant, which makes hierarchy irrelevant. It's any form of action which completely bypasses all the indirect routes through legal process, and it's basically not going to people and asking for something or demanding something or threatening the powers that be. We won't vote for you if you don't do this. We will try to close you down by various legal means unless you comply with us and do this, that and the other. Basically, it's sweeping all that aside. Direct action is the essence of radical revolutionary action, in that, in the true sense of radical, which everyone has forgotten these days, in that it gets to the root of oppression. think about the history of direct action and the animal liberation movement. Liberations, economic sabotage, these things are not asking for anything. They're going straight to where injustice happens. They're changing the world. They're creating the world that we want. They're destroying injustice, and they're creating the beginnings of justice, if you know what I mean. It's like...
Yeah. Well, I'm pulling a few strands together from your agenda then. One thing I think that is confusing for people within the animal advocacy movement in particular is that this position has got a critique of banning things. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that. So could you explain why that wouldn't be the focus?
Sure. I mean, as an anarchist, obviously I'm highly sceptical about the rationale behind ban this, ban that, etc. What does the whole philosophy of banning something rest on? It rests on authority. It rests on an appeal to authority. Ultimately, it rests on force, which is a form of violence. It's like saying, we have to make people be compassionate. We have to sort of rely on laws and rules and hierarchy. It is going to the system and it's asking the system to do something. That's not direct action. That's what I mean. Definitions of direct action tend to get very fuzzy, exactly like definition of the word radical. You find it gets hazier and hazier. These days, there tends to be a misapprehension. Direct action means something that looks exciting or controversial. Like, the louder you scream outside a shop, that must be direct action because it could get you in trouble. It's not. It's in direct action that there is a middleman, in a non-sexist fashion, a middle person. You're going there and you're saying, you're addressing someone. It is not direct in the sense that someone is being asked to do something for you.
Yeah.
Or you're demanding that somebody do something for you. So that, basically, the anarchist take on banning things is that it actually upholds and reinforces a violent culture which is based on coercion. What's the VIP take, I would say, wouldn't you, on the whole ban thing is, our target is culture. An oppressive culture will not change no matter how many bans you throw at it. You've got to change the roots of oppression, and the roots of oppression are the way people are socialised to be oppressive. The oppressive habits which... in which we're thoroughly socialised as we grow up, you know? It's just kind of...
You can't
ban a culture. It's not going to work. It's just... it's.
Yeah, what the argument would be is that you can ban elements within the culture and then that would then create generational change. So you could, for example, have a situation where hunting is legal. You then ban hunting and then people are born into society in which hunting is illegal, and that makes a change in the culture. Now, that possibly could be true. I think you could probably make a case for that, but the effort you've taken and the time you've taken in focusing on that one issue could just be talking to people ethically on across the board. And so that's what would create a larger change, because rather than getting people to change one thing at a time, as it were, oh, don't go to the circus, and oh, by the way, after that, don't go. You're asking them to do kind of everything at once by talking about veganism, about talking about justice, about talking about the intersectional and entangled nature of oppression. You're not kind of trying to let them in on the secret one by one, as though, you know, like a politician would.
Yes, I would completely agree with your practical critique of activists trying to get bans. I do agree that there are immense practical issues, but of course, as an anarchist, I have huge theoretical problems with the idea behind it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I would continue to have those problems. The generational change argument wouldn't sway that for me. It wouldn't change it, because what are we relying on there? We're relying on the concept that people are born into a world where something is illegal, therefore they grow up in a world where it's considered immoral. What are we doing? Once again, we're equating legality with morality.
And also do what you're told rather than do what's
right.
Yeah,
again, all we're doing is reinforcing authority. If something is banned, oh, it has to be wrong then, because once again, we're referring to authority. We're looking up at politicians, the cops, you know, I don't know, whoever, the state, any form of authority. We're looking at people who've set themselves above us, systems that oppress us. We're looking to them to see what's right and wrong. We should be looking inside ourselves. We should be finding it out from... We should be asking ourselves hard questions about the way we live our lives. That's the way to find justice and a compassionate society and a peaceful world. It's not going to happen no matter how much you ban. All you're ultimately doing is reinforcing the way people reference authority figures and everything that they do. So I don't see the generational change argument makes any difference for me, because that's exactly the same, equating legality with morality.
And so have you exhausted your limitations of legal protest there, or is it...
No. It would take several weeks to exhaust them.
So what's to add on that then?
In case I'm going over the same ground and just ranting, shut me up here, but I think one problem, as I have on the handout I designed for the workshop, is that with legal protest, there is an implication that legality, while maybe not at present synonymous with morality, could be made to be so. It's like, ban this, make that illegal, longer prison sentences for abusers, blah, 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 you know? All this kind of stuff is doing is implying that the legal system is not inherently oppressive, not inherently irrelevant to justice.
Mm.
It's saying that somehow you could construct a legal system that would make a peaceful world. It's ignoring the legal system as a form of oppression. I actually remember back in when I was a bit younger and getting in some...
In the good old days.
Bad old days, when I got in legal bother a few times. And I remember being very aware of how much time I was wasting going through the court system and being on bail, so I couldn't do anything and everything. And also, it was very distasteful to me how you would go to court and you would put a lot of effort into showing that, actually, no, officer, I didn't break this law, or you quoted the wrong law when you arrested me, and you were looking for all these loopholes. Basically, you were trying to cheat the system, kind of play the system on its own terms, and show how you hadn't actually broken the law, or you were justifying doing this because... And that, in a way, was also grovelling to the system, and that was highly distasteful. I wanted to be able to be true to myself and say, yeah, I broke the law, so what, you know? I should have done. It was the right thing to do, you know? Mm. So I just find that all legal protest kind of rests on this premise of, I don't know, kind of distasteful respect for the legal system and the system as a whole, you know? It's kind of...
You certainly do see that when people come up to the gazebo, and they're quite often, when you're trying to make a point, especially if it's analogous, where they've, but that one's legal and that one's not. So there is a confusion in there.
There is. So people think, if it's not illegal, if it's not banned... We must be cool with it then, because the governments, the cops, wouldn't let us do this if there was something wrong with it. It's kind of like the equally oppressive, dangerous construct. Everybody does that. It's the same kind of mentality, isn't it? It shirks individual responsibility, and I think that's a very dangerous element of legal protest, actually. That, once again, we're kind of bypassing the responsibility we all have to create a peaceful world, a respectful, just world. We're going to somebody else and shouting at them to create this world. It's actually up to us. So,
okay, so moving on then, what's next?
I don't know. I think we can cross off legal protest, otherwise I will just rant all day about that.
Well, what about this thing about, you know, a very kind of anarchic thing is the idea that kind of almost like destruction is creativity. Maybe you could go into that a little bit.
Yes, that's one of the most appealing elements of direct action for me, is that it is completely in tune with the anarchist belief that a revolution must be both destructive and creative, and that those elements can be brought together in every action.
And this is bound up with Marcuse too, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. It is. Essentially, what I think is that each revolutionary action must have both a destructive and a creative element, in that it must help to deconstruct, to destroy, to shake the foundations of the oppressive constructs and the oppressive society we have built in which we've imprisoned everyone.
Let me interject right there, because a lot of people listening to this might be saying, yeah, but what's this got to do with veganism? Because veganism is not seen as that radical, whereas an expansive, original view of veganism, in my view, would be entirely in tune with this. It's a kind of feeling about veganism that's been lost, needs to be recreated, don't you think?
Yes, I do. I think that the anarchist ideal of destructive creative revolution, destroying the old society, creating a new world,
that's what veganism is, isn't it?
Yes, that's the essence of veganism. Veganism, in its true intersectional spirit of justice and breaking down barriers, and there's a very anarchic element to veganism. I understand anarchy to be
veganism. And what this is not meaning is that veganism is just about, well, okay, you start to buy that rather than buy this.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's another common misconception about veganism, which is actually very useful to the system, because the system has begun to actually sell veganism as consumerism.
Yeah, back to itself.
Well, the infamous green consumerism construct, which is basically, we will sell you revolution so long as you keep buying, you know? So basically, it's a way to buy the revolution, you know? It's kind of...
Yeah, well, the example I used to give in sociology is when they started to put out tailored bin bags for the punks, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I always feel very tragic when I go into all these kind of alternative clothing stores and they have pre-ripped jeans. Yeah. That all seems to me to make a complete joke.
And the Che Guevara thing gets to you, doesn't it?
Yes, very much. Yeah. Yes, Che Guevara's face plastered all over T-shirts of people who are usually also wearing Nike, and pre-ripped jeans, making a complete joke out of the whole concept of DIY culture and rejection of oppressive fashion and culture. It's just... Yeah, basically, iconic revolutionary figures like Che Guevara, and revolutionary concepts like rejection of fashion and the whole ethic of DIY punk culture, they are co-opted and sold back to us as these cheap symbols.
And thereby neutered. And
yeah, they become fashion.
Yeah, my worry is that that's what, over the recent years, that's what happened to veganism.
Oh, absolutely. Veganism has become basically the animal rights version of a Che Guevara t-shirt. It's become like this symbol you can buy that fits with your image or something. It's become this limited consumerist thing. So much so that you can... There really is a belief within veganism that you can get a product off a shelf, you can look at it, and if it says suitable for vegans, you can buy it with a clear conscience, and that's it. That's where justice ends. Justice doesn't end there.
That's a starting point.
It's the very beginning. And I think we've lost that element to veganism. To come back to, you know, like the original question, the original point I was making, we need to get back to our understanding. We need to rediscover our understanding of veganism as this profoundly radical, destructive, creative concept that just cannot contain all the barriers, all the limitations, all the hypocrisy that have crept into the vegan movement. It's, in its essence, it is an anarchic movement. I would understand it to be synonymous with anarchy. I'm a vegan because I'm an anarchist and vice versa, you know? So I would see veganism, living veganism, living the Great Refusal through vegan values, is direct action against an oppressive culture. It's both destructive and challenging to the culture we have, and it is the very beginning, the core of creating a different world. So I think those things must go together in every action, every act of resistance, that and every choice that we make every day. So
you still see quite a lot of anarchist symbols within animal rights and some elements of veganism. Do you trust that, or are you...?
No, I'm deeply sceptical. I tend to think that the way that manifests itself is it's basically yet another thing that's been cheapened and made meaningless. It's been sold back to us as something that looks cool. It's incredibly superficial. I think that there are elements of the animal rights movement, as I think there are probably elements of every social justice movement, including the anarchist movement, if we're going to divide these things up, as most people do, that adopt kind of anarchy symbols as basically part of their image, their revolutionary image. I did also want to make a point which arose in the workshop about what we're not saying. Because people tend to hear a critique of legal protest, they interpret that, no matter how many times you make it absolutely clear this is not what you're saying, they interpret that as advocacy of inaction, that you are against activism, that you're saying do nothing, because it doesn't work. Basically, they construe a critique of legal protest as advocacy of apathy. What we're saying is more efficient action. I am a believer in the zero-sum game factor, in that there's few of us, and why are we not thinking, what will change the world most quickly? What will save most victims? Ironically enough, the usual defence of legal action I get when I talk about this is, there's not time for these discussions. You sit around talking and people are dying. Absolutely. We need to stop sitting around talking while people are dying. We need to work out what we should do to save most lives, to change culture most profoundly, to get to the root of oppression, and to change things. And that's what I'm saying. I'm saying the way to do that is through direct action, is through making the powers that be irrelevant, is through complete rejection of hierarchy. That's why I'm a supporter of direct action. It's not because I advocate inaction. It's not because we as a group advocate inaction. We advocate urgent action, but we advocate meaningful, consistent action based on intersectional vegan values.
Yeah, so here's something that you probably agree with Francione about, because he's got a bit of a bugbear about the fact that people are very kind of theoretically all over the place in this movement. The movement, as we know, is a philosophical mess, with, you know, Singer's views being paramount and all this kind of stuff. And so this brings me to some work a colleague of mine in Bangor University, Alexandra Plows. She was looking at the road protest and Earth First, and they perfected a way of, you know, working, doing direct action, doing action, but always theorizing at the same time. And so rather than thinking, if you're not for this demo, you're not doing anything, and all you do is talk, the ideal situation, the ideal type, would be to formulate a situation where you are actually doing things, so that's the action, but you're also theorizing at the same time, so it's a simultaneous thing, right?
Yes, there are two things I'd like to say about that. The first is that what you've described is, again, the anarchist ideal, which is that theory is formulated in practice and vice versa. The two things develop together. You do not have isolated theory.
You don't even think of them as something apart.
No, you don't. They are parts of anarchist praxis, which is like the combination of theory and action, they go together. And the other thing I would like to say is that actually it's incredibly arrogant and limiting viewpoint that if you are against a particular type of action, you must, by default, automatically be saying do nothing. I actually find that quite an astonishing critique, because one thing people are very bad at, in general, across most social movements, I think, but particularly within the animal liberation movement, which, as you point out, is an absolute theoretical shambles, is self-criticism. We're really shit at self-criticism. And so much so that when we find it, we don't trust it or recognise it. What I'm advocating here is the anarchist ideal of be your own harshest critic. That is how theory is formulated in action, and that is how action gets more efficient and more effective and more revolutionary. You do an action, you critique it viciously yourself about what you did, what you won't do next time, what was the message here, was it consistent with your values, and you do that every time you do an action, and you use what you learn. And that's how that's how we as a social movement will develop, by critiquing ourselves, striving to remain true to ourselves, and building a tradition of direct action based on honesty and self-criticism.
Yeah, we sociologists would call that reflexivity.
That's what I was looking for, honest self-criticism.
Yeah, movement reflexivity is important. So as an anarchist then, could I ask you this question about the anarchist movement? Are they any good at reflexivity?
Again,
that's where it should be the strongest, right?
Yes, it should be. But here I do want to say that one key area in which the anarchist movement endlessly disappoints me is the refusal to extend anarchist values to our fellow animals, you know?
Mm.
There are large elements of the anarchist movement where veganism is not considered to be synonymous with anarchy, where it's not considered to even be a part of anarchist values, where it's not even considered to be necessary to be a consistent anarchist. I just think if you don't live a vegan life, you lead a life based on hierarchical oppression. I just think ultimately the anarchist message is your privilege is somebody else's oppression, and we should fight against our own privilege as enthusiastically, as committedly, as honestly, with as much integrity as we fight against our own oppression.
Okay, now, just as we come to the end of this, and so I want to focus on this word privilege, because privilege is a big part of the thrust of intersectionality. So maybe you could say something about that in terms of the fact that we have to be self-critical about our own privilege, and to put it into an intersectional position where you're looking at all the struggles and also the history of it across the piece. So if you're part of a movement, learn something about the history, but also look at it in an intersectional way, right?
Yes, I would absolutely say that. The lack of interest in our movement's history is very disappointing to me. And I would also say, if you look at the history of direct action, it is intersectional. Direct action is how things have changed throughout history. If you look at the radical feminist, black liberation, anarchist struggles, direct action is always the core of those movements. It's how things have changed in those movements. Because what those movements all did, they recognised that you have to shake up cultural oppression. You have to go to the root, which is the culture. You have to change the way we think. You have to examine the way you think yourself. And here is where I'm talking about privilege. A practical example of that, if anyone's wondering what I'm on about, is like, it would be easy for me, kind of reasonably most of the time, to a certain degree, financially secure white woman to
a lot
of qualifications. I'm just thinking that's not strictly true even as I'm saying it, but you know, yeah. In a relative position of security and living in this country, a white woman, it's okay for me to say, yell at somebody who works in McDonald's and say, you should leave your job, that you're making money from oppression. And that person could be an immigrant, this person could be feeding their kids, this person could not have another option. And that would be an example of really obnoxious counter-revolutionary behaviour and lack of self-criticism on my part. That would be an example of enjoying my privilege in the most unthinking, ignorant and repellent way from a revolutionary perspective.
Well, actually then, gives us, spend the next couple of minutes just talking about some of the most recent direct action you've been involved with, which ironically pulls those things together. It should be reflexive because it's a kind of evolving idea, but it also does shake up the culture and it doesn't target the individuals.
That's right, yeah. I have been lucky enough to be part of some disruptions recently, which involved a group of us would go into places of violence and disrupt the calm acceptance, disrupt the culture which accepted that violence. And key elements of the philosophy of this tactic and why it appealed to me were because individuals, you're not screaming at individuals, you are not enjoying your privilege, your relative security, compared to, say, an immigrant worker in one of these places who you're screaming at and calling an evil scumbag. You know, you're not doing that. Instead, you are targeting culture. You are shaking up the silence. You're breaking the silence. You're shaking up the complacency around participation in violence. You are pointing out that there is no such thing as neutrality. We don't experience participation in violence as a choice in this culture, but it is a choice. Resistance is a choice. You can choose to be complicit, you can choose to resist. And the core of this action, in my view, is what makes it part of Marcuse's great refusal.
Indeed.
In that it is refusing that silence, that complicity. It is going into these places and it's making people aware of the culture which has made them conceive of what they are part of as normal, acceptable. Okay, it's changing that. Basically, it's putting questions in people's minds. It is part of, again, the anarchist ideal, and part of the Great Refusal, the theme of the Great Refusal, which is questioning everything.
One of the great things about what's happened in Ireland with this new idea that's kind of been brought back, from the States, so thanks, Roisin, on this.
Thank you, Roisin.
But one of the great things about it is that so far it's going to be in women-only actions and empowerment, and that, you know, so again, very intersectional in that sense, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the last action occurred yesterday, and straight after the action, there were, like, five of us involved, all women. We went straight from the final direct action at a chain store. We went straight from there to a pro-choice march. And I can just... It was a really inspiring, empowering experience for me. And I remember, like, walking beside these women in the march and just thinking, this is so amazing to do things that I really believe in. They're really shaking things up with these people. So if any of you happen to be listening to this podcast, you rock. I love you. Thank you.
Right, okay. So drawing this finally to an end now, I want to thank you for recording this series with us. I also want to thank you for initially agreeing to do your workshops and everything for VIP, which has been absolutely awesome. It was the perfect end to our mini course. I guess I could say that VIP are kind of thinking of doing a radio show, so we're hoping to do a recording of that fairly soon. So we're not totally sure what it's going to be yet, but that's the come, isn't it?
So. Yeah, it's a very exciting idea, though. We've yet to find out exactly what it will look like, but it will be an adventure finding that out. I would also like to point out that we're thinking, aren't we, about doing an Introducing Zami podcast, which will cover right, some issues
that were arisen
which she has
by
raised
just
since,
walking the streets with Zami the Hound.
Yeah, and since she came into my life and everything, have a look at cultural speciesism and basically her story as she's made it clear to me, parts of it and everything, so that should be thought-provoking and revolutionary, I hope, so, and will kind of hopefully coincide with me finishing writing a zine about her and about meeting her and living with her, so look out for those things, people.
Okay, and especially you, Irina, because we know you're listening. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.